Welcome to PCMC. Pop culture, man. Children. This is Halloween 2025. I can't believe we're at Halloween 2025 already. This show's 8 years old. We've done so many of these Halloween fucking shows. I'm here today with my spooky friend and yours, Peter. Last Voyage of the Demeter, Marsh.
Hello, how's it going, man?
Very good. How are you doing?
I'm great. I love being on your show. And you were just telling me that this is my third Halloween episode, so I'm pretty honored.
Yeah, you did Nightmare on Elm Street for Slashix. And then last year we did Wolfman for Universal Monsters. And you look like you're wearing a Ghostface t-shirt, so you're ready.
Yes. Did you start doing Halloween episodes in your very first year?
My very first episode would have been a Halloween episode. So, our very first episode that we put out was, the end of October. So, I guess we talked a little bit about Halloween, but it wasn't a Halloween special. But then the next year we started, but I don't think we did all... That was just one special. It was a year or so before we were like, no, we're going to do every episode in October as Halloween.
Right.
Which is actually a lot of planning. Halloween time is the best time for me, but I'm also like, oh, we got to get all these recordings done and all this shit.
Right. I love the Halloween time as well. And I am actually super excited to talk about the movie you've picked for today.
Well, before we talk about the movie, tell me, do you have any Halloween plans this year?
Yeah. I mean, okay. So I have two jobs and one of them is
delivering pizza.
Yes. Yes. It's a nightmare.
Eating two incomes to survive.
But one of them is Marco's, where I deliver pizzas on the side, and they always want me to work on Halloween night. Not going to do that. Yeah, Halloween night is actually one of the busiest nights of the year for delivering pizzas. So,
what is it?
Yes, sir. There's Halloween, there's Christmas night, not Christmas Eve, because people have already done their thing and they're just chilling out on Christmas night. There's the Super Bowl. But Halloween is the biggest one.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's VHS story. You go and then the doors open and it's haunted. And then somebody flies because someone always flies. And then it ends in violence.
Yeah, I am not going to be delivering pizzas on Halloween. I'll be with my kids. We'll probably do a little bit of trick-or-treating.
Nice.
And there's some fun stuff in my neighborhood, too. So, do you have any plans?
Yeah, man. We do the full hard. We're going to... So, upstate... I forget where exactly, but upstate is where Charles Adams is from. So, and he lives in this cute little upstate neighborhood. And you could go see his house, which looks... It's a beautiful, Victorian, so it looks like the Addams Family house. But then this little town, what is it called? I was just looking at it. This little town takes the fact that he comes from there so seriously, and they do Addams Fest. It's Westfield. So is it Connecticut or is it New York? Well, anyway, so they take it super, they love the fact that Charles Addams comes from there. So they do Addams Fest. So they do this year's theme is Morticia. So there's an art exhibit of Morticia art. And then there's actually a restaurant there, a nice restaurant there called Adams's or whatever. Okay. We're doing that. We always go for a day trip to Sleepy Hollow. Cause there's a really nice, have you ever been to Sleepy Hollow?
I have not. No.
Basically there's not a ton to do, right? There's a huge old cemetery, which is beautiful to just walk through. And there's some really nice restaurants. And right outside the cemetery is the little bridge where supposedly the Headless Horseman was. But there's a cool Headless Horseman sculpture. So we do it every year just because we love that restaurant and we love just looking at the... Me and my girlfriend don't have any problem doing the exact same thing every year. We don't need something new. Yeah. Let's take our trip to Sleepy Hollow. So we're going to do that. And, for me personally, it's just I watch a lot of horror. I read a lot of horror.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Danny and I will be doing that over on the LasterCast too, just sort of reviewing more movies than usual, And nice. Not even a show if there's a show on. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no show this year. The last couple of years, Shudder has had like last year they had like Horror's Greatest around this time, and then the year before that they had that great like 100 scariest moments or whatever. This year they don't have anything, which is a bummer.
Maybe the wind's been taken out of their sails. The world is kind of a horrifying place right now anyway. So like, let's
Yeah,
not put too
that's
much effort
true.
into our programming.
That's true. But yes, today I'm very excited to talk to you about Phantasm from the year of 1979, only 2 years after Star Wars. And I think that's significant because this movie has Jawas in it. And
Right.
it also has a Bene Gesserit witch in it. So this movie's pulling from a lot of places. I guess I want to I want to tell you about my sort of not real history, but kind of history with Phantasm, and then I want to know yours. Mine is that I had always heard about it and seen stuff from it, and all I really ever knew was this orb, the orb that like flies through the air, this like silver sphere, and then like spikes come out of it and like goes on your face and like kills you. That's all I ever knew. And often Phantasm would be like mentioned in the same breath as like things that I was much more familiar with, like Nightmare on Elm Street and Hellraiser and Friday the 13th. But I hadn't seen it until last year. So last year I was like, okay, I'm gonna watch Phantasm. And I didn't love it because I don't know what I was expecting, but it was not at all what I was expecting at all, even a little bit. But I've been thinking about it since then. And then you and I did a recording on Bubba Ho-Tep, which is the same director. So it's kind of been in the back of my mind. And then we decided to do this episode, and then I rewatched it like 2 nights ago, and I like absolutely loved it. Like I actually watched it the last 2 days in a row, which is rare for me. It's that's why I say like it's critics who are like, oh, I saw it, this is how I feel. It's like, but maybe you had a bad meal that day, but maybe you didn't sleep enough, maybe your brain was in the right place. When I first saw Phantasm, I was like, what is this? I'm a little bored. I don't get it. When I watched it the other night, I was like, oh my God, this is so rich. This is like, let's bring up Lynch because we always talk about Lynch. This is closer to a David Lynch movie than it is to a horror movie. This is closer to Mulholland Drive than it is A Nightmare on Elm Street. And I just absolutely, now I'm obsessed with it. I'm like, I haven't seen any of the sequels. So I kind of think tonight maybe I'll start watching the sequels. Although you let me know because I know you've seen the sequels. If it gets bad, maybe I won't ruin it by watching the sequels. But I just think the movie is so goddamn fascinating. What is your history with Phantasm?
Yeah, I don't remember the first time I saw it. I know that it was recent, though. It had to have been like, I think after I started the LasterCast, which is going like 5 years now. It's there's those shows, those clip shows. You mentioned a couple of them on Shudder, where it's like 101 scariest horror movie moments. There was those horror movie awards. I know you covered them on your channel one
Yeah.
time, but they would reference that. You'd see kind of Angus Scrimm being the tall man in some kind of horror celebration, he'd be at
Yes.
conventions and stuff. So it always had this presence, but I hadn't watched it. And I had the exact same thought process as you. I'm like, okay, there's these like flying orbs. They like shoot out blades and then you get killed by them. But what else is going on? And then I watched it, I don't know, in the past couple of years. I thought I had watched the second one as well. But then when I went to go rewatch it again, every single one of them is on Peacock, like 1 through 5. There's 5 Phantasm movies. There's actually a YouTube documentary called Phantasmagoria that you can just watch on YouTube for free. I watched that as well. So I watched all that over the course of the past week. But you're right. You're right. It's a very bizarre, weird movie. And I think that like kind of the path we could take first that'll kind of help us unpack this movie is talking about Don Coscarelli, the filmmaker.
Sure.
Like Don Coscarelli, his filmography is really interesting. He did like 2 dramas prior to Phantasm,
Oh,
and
really?
a lot of the cast for Phantasm are in the movie right before it, which is like this like drama where there's like a drunken father, and the drunken father is Angus Scrimm,
Oh.
and A. Michael Baldwin is the little kid in this movie too. I can't remember the fucking name of it off the top of my head right now, but like Don Coscarelli, he makes really small budget movies, and then they're quirky and weird. They could easily be dismissed as being silly or stupid. Like you could easily do that for Bubba Hotep. You could do that
Sure.
for Phantasm. You could certainly do it for Phantasm's sequels. But I
Was
think
he
that like
involved in the sequels?
Don Coscarelli wrote all four.
Oh shit.
He wrote all four Phantasm movies, like one through four. He directed all of those four. He co-wrote the fifth one, and another man directed the fifth one.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
That you I should say with this with Phantasm One, he does everything. He wrote and directed it. He's also the cinematographer and the editor. The only thing he doesn't do is he's not John Carpenter. He doesn't do his own scores. The score is by Fred Myhrvold and Malcolm Seagrave, and the score is so good to this movie.
Yes. Like one of the things that I love to think about with movies is like the interesting choices that people make. You know, a movie could have a completely different feel if they didn't pick this particular thing. And the score for Phantasm matches the movie so well.
Yeah, because it's got a melancholy to it. It's got like a sadness to it. And it's kind of about sad things too. It takes place around a cemetery and a mortuary and when I was watching it recently, like 2 nights ago, it occurred to me that like a good critical prism to maybe look at the movie through is through like the idea of liminal spaces, because especially like liminal spaces as like, I mean, the idea of liminal space has been around for a long time, but it's become an internet thing, almost kind of adjacent to things like analog horror and like creepypasta. Like this, like you'll see like online like these videos of like sometimes they're AI, but like there'll be videos of like liminal spaces. And it'll be like an office building, but it's closed down and there's no like chairs in it. Or it'll be like an old mall, right? And liminal means in between, right? Like an in-between place. And so from that point of view, like, of course, like a mortuary is a liminal space because it's in between life and death. And in this movie, it's in between two worlds, right? The sci-fi aspect of it or the cosmic horror aspect of it. But then I think you can expand that to the whole plot. Like, I think the two main characters, this guy Jody, who's like a young man in his 20s, and his younger brother, who's like his younger brother Michael, who's in his teens, I think they're both in a liminal space because they're like adults and children at the same time. There's no parent. So sometimes Jody's like a parent, but sometimes he's not. Sometimes the kid is a little kid, like being a little kid. Like he's got like toys like hanging from his ceiling, but he also like can work on cars and drive cars, but he can also like the brother punishes him and like puts him in his like so I think the whole movie is kind of about being stuck in between things. I think, and I said this also about another movie we talked about this Halloween, Dressed to Kill. This movie is sort of in between the 70s and 80s in a lot of ways. There's very 70s things about it and very 80s things about it.
Oh, that is oof, that is a beautiful point, man. Yeah, I mean, so you're getting right to the liminal spaces money shot thing for us today, huh?
Go
Before
cool,
we even talk
sure.
about the plot. And that's fine, you know. Yeah, in all the Phantasm movies, there is similar cinematography. There's always the mausoleum, pretty
Yeah.
much in all of them, and it's always this empty mausoleum. Usually there's a flying orb kind of coming through it at one point and it gets somebody. That happens in like pretty much every movie. This movie, they talk about it in the documentary where it's like clearly influenced by like Italian horror filmmakers.
Sure.
My experience with Italian horror filmmakers is pretty limited. You probably have seen way more than I have, but I've pretty much just seen Argento stuff. And you know, we covered Argento stuff on the Lasser cast, and that was a lot of fun. I'd never watched any of his work, and I really fucking loved like the four movies that we covered. When I see certain shots in this movie, I feel like I'm watching an Italian horror film, especially when they're in the mortuary, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, the white juxtaposed with the deep crimson red is very, very, it's very giallo.
Yeah. And I know exactly what you're saying with the feeling of like it's kind of 70s, it's kind of 80s, because I kind of associate that 70s horror vibe, like kind of like with what you see in Phantasm. I'm like, oh yeah, that feels like a 70s Italian horror film. And then it's funny because like the series goes from 1979 to 2016, right? And you have one that's in 79, then you have another one that's in 84, and then you have one that's in 88. And no, I'm sorry, I'm off with my math. It's 79, 88, 94. There we go. I got it that time. And so the one that's like in 88, that feels like it's in a transitional space, a liminal space between the 80s and the 90s,
Well, interesting.
which to me, a lot of my foundational horror comes from that exact time period where it's like it kind of feels like it's an 80s movie, but then it also feels like a 90s movie.
Yeah.
That's like my bread and butter because that's when I was sort of like aware of movies at that point, and I'd see trailers for horror movies, and horror movies really affected me in that like sort of late 80s, early 90s period.
Okay. But you still miss this somehow.
I
Like
did miss
me,
Phantasm. I
you
think,
didn't watch it till later.
yeah. I think that like when we're growing up, there's just sort of the staples that everyone kind of talks about, just like through cultural osmosis. Even if you haven't seen the movie, you know what it's about. And everyone from our generation, everyone knows about Freddy, Michael Myers, Jason. Like, it's just like a given, right? Then you have to like actively pursue other movies. And
Yeah.
it helps if you have like horror fan friends because they'll turn you on to stuff. And for most of my life, up until like the Lasser cast and stuff, I actually didn't really have horror fan friends, you know. And then all of a sudden, I met Danny, and he's just fucking seen like everything. He's probably watching a movie like right now, you
Yeah.
know, at 8 a.m. while we're recording this. But like, it just Phantasm. Just I never took the time to watch it, and like I think just bringing it back to Don Coscarelli, that's what made it so appealing because his choices for what he makes. That's really interesting to me.
So as a director, like what choices in this film strike you as like that's a brilliant choice that he made?
Well, one thing that's really interesting, and it actually kind of has significance later on in the series too, is that when they filmed this, they took 2 years to make this movie. And what happened was they had no money whatsoever. So they would rent the film equipment on the weekend. But they would do it in such a way where they got it on a Friday. That way, essentially, they were paying for 2 days, but they would like have 3 days of having the equipment because like they couldn't return it to the place, right? So they would film on the weekends, and they just filmed hours and hours and hours of this movie. And there's all these shots that you haven't seen in this original movie
Wow.
that they actually use in like Phantasm 4, where it's like stuff that they filmed in the 70s, and it's just like character beats. Where it just shows like, you know, Mike like riding on the back of Reggie's ice cream truck and Reggie playing some music in a bar. And there's all these moments where like there's just so much more to it and they cut it down to make this movie. But because they worked on it for 2 years, they really built up like the friendships between the cast. And the main characters like Mike and Jody and Reggie, they're in like every single movie too.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, that's really interesting. Yeah, because
Yeah.
well, I
Go
don't
ahead.
want to jump ahead, but God, we're already all over the place. You know, you said something about the plot. I do imagine with an episode like this that a lot of people have seen it, but we could talk. I think you could we could explain the plot really quickly because I think the actual like narrative through line is fairly simple. It's a lot of going back and forth. But what makes the movie unique is just all of the other stuff. It begins with a friend. We'll get into there's a whole queer aspect to this I want to get into as well. But
Sure.
this guy he gets killed while having sex with this beautiful woman who they call the Lady in Lavender. She stabs him, and then we see she's actually the character, the tall man, who's the sort of like antagonist, I guess, of this series. And then it's his funeral, and his two best friends, Jody and Reggie, are there at the funeral. We find out that Jody, his parents died a year or two ago, and he's kind of taking care of his younger brother, Michael. Michael likes to like kind of like go around and like spy on things and shit, and he follows his brother around. He sees that the tall man from the mortuary like is like super strong and weird. He breaks into the mortuary and he where he finds like the little Jawa people. He can he go oh he gets chased by the tall man. He cuts the tall man's fingers off. The fingers are moving on their own. He shows it to his brother. His brother now believes him. He decides to go. He gets attacked by Jawas. There's a lot of back and forth. If there's one thing that I let me finish. So there's back and forth. They keep going, but eventually we find out that in the mortuary there's well these little Jawa people were actually the dead people from the place. They're somehow squashed down to like 3 foot tall. And they're like kind of like zombie people, but they look like Jawas because they have like the hoods like Jawas. And I guess they do the bidding of the tall man. I guess the reason they're out and about is because they know that this family is onto them. And at the end, they find there's like this secret room in the mortuary, or I should say mausoleum, where it's all white and it's like it gets very cosmic horror. And there are all these ca black canisters with like the little Jawas are inside of them, and it goes to another world that's like all red, and the Jawas are used as slaves there. It's if it sounds like it doesn't make sense, that's okay because it doesn't. And then it ends, and they trick the tall man into falling down a mine shaft. But then the younger character wakes up, and supposedly his older brother Jody is dead, and that was a dream, and the whole thing was a dream. And he's with his the he's being raised by the friend Reggie. But then that, I guess, is a dream too, and then it's over. That's basically it. The through line is pretty simple.
Yeah.
Like I was gonna say, the thing that I like the most about this movie is that it doesn't feel any need, and this is where it's Lynchian. It feels no need in explaining things to you. It feels no need in saying, oh, this is this, and that's why this. It's just weird, and there's things in it that make no sense, and you just believe that they make sense in the mind of the filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean, you did a pretty good job summarizing the whole thing, but you also sounded like a person that was like on anesthesia talking about a movie. You know, like this sounded like you were saying like complete nonsense, but that is the movie.
Yeah,
Like,
it is nonsense.
yeah,
It is.
like we just like as humans who consume media, we just start to like figure out a movie before the movie tells us what's going on. We're
Sure,
like,
we're
okay,
reading
I
it
see this
afterwards.
thing. I'm sorry, say that again.
We're actively reading it.
Right. So we're like, okay, I see this person, like we never see him during the day. You know, these people are missing. Okay, he's probably a vampire. Like we make those conclusions. When you watch Phantasm, it's like you start to make your conclusions, and then they just throw in this weird random element where you're like, what the fuck is this? You know, like, because there's so many different elements, and each one would be its own horror movie or sci-fi movie. Like you would have a movie that would just be about these creepy Jawa creatures. Maybe they would have like a human kind of handler person, like the tall man, but that would be it. But then all of a sudden, like the tall man can like turn into this woman, and when you cut his hand, like yellowish greenish blood shoots out of his fingers, and then you're kind of like experiencing things in dreams, but then you're not experiencing things in dreams. It's
And when you cut his fingers off, they could turn into like weird fly scarab monsters somehow.
Yeah, so like the movie, it's really interesting because I think in general with horror, you're always gonna like err on the horror side and just be like, oh, it's a supernatural thing. And there'll be like a kind of a simplified explanation. But then with this, it's like it's horror, but then all of a sudden it becomes this sci-fi like movie towards the end. You know, and then like it changes over the time of the sequels as well, like where it becomes almost like a little bit more like an action movie. And we won't have to talk about that, but I do want to talk about the sequels at one point. But I want to bring it back to what you said about how there aren't explanations. There's a lot of scenes where like Jody and Mike are kind of speculating as to what's going on, and Reggie like gives his two cents, but like there's no like definitive thing where the tall man's like, this is my plan, we do this. There's nothing like that.
He really says like two things in the movie. He says, "Sir, the funeral is about to begin," and then he says,
Right.
"Boy," twice. That's the famous line, "Boy." And then at one point, he's like telepathically talking to Michael, and he says, "Like, you play games, but it's time for you to die, or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, the movie is kind of like a Goosebumps book where like
Oh.
R.L. Stine just got really ambitious and just went off the deep end, you know? It's like every time you think you got it under, you know, you understand it, it's like, "Oh, well, there's this weird other element here now."
Yeah, it would seem, and maybe this is what I thought when I first watched it. Like, it would seem sloppy and ill-conceived, if it weren't so well put together. That's why I feel like I say like it's more Lynchian now, because I'm like, no, it's not sloppy. It's not ill-conceived. There's a depth there, and there's a world. The world of that's another thing. Like Lynch, you feel like, despite this story I'm watching, the world that this takes place in is its own world with its own rules. And you get that from this. You totally get that from this. I mean, we haven't even talked about the fortune teller.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about the fortune teller, and it's kind of funny because David Lynch made Dune, and there's a scene very, very similar to this scene in Dune, and it's in the book, and it's in every adaptation of Dune as well. We'll talk about that one second, but we really should talk about David Lynch and this, right?
Sure.
Because I do think that, like, you know, David Lynch is from a different generation than Don Coscarelli, right? Like, Don Coscarelli would have been like a teenager, he would have been growing up seeing David Lynch's early works. And I think that David Lynch is more kind of like classically trained and aware than Don Coscarelli. Don Coscarelli, it's so funny, like saying his name, you kind of think that he's like a character on The Sopranos or something. And when you picture him like talking, you know, in an interview, you picture him be like, "Hey, so I made the orbs, you know, like it was cool." But he's not like that. He's like very like working class. He looks, I don't know, he might be Canadian or something, but he's very like, you know, white kind of bland guy, but he makes these weird, weird fucking movies. Lynch is just weird as a person to begin with. And one of the things that's very different with David Lynch work from Don Coscarelli work is that even stuff that you would consider to be like in a normal setting in a David Lynch movie or in Twin Peaks is still weird. Like people say weird things. It's edited in a weird way where like the scene begins where you're not expecting to begin, or it changes to another scene, then it comes back. Don Coscarelli is like not as ambitious as that. Like there's clear scenes of like in this movie, like this is just the normal time. These are just regular characters talking. And then there's the weird sci-fi fantasy shit. It's not like the people are weird.
Well, I don't know. I think that they're maybe not in a Lynchian way. I'm not saying this is exactly like a Lynch movie. I just think that's a good comp to draw. But I do think they're like, why are all the women blonde? Why, like, the two women that run the antique shop later on,
Yeah.
what's their deal? And also, at one point, Reggie later says, I found them and I found a bunch of other women and I let them go. So, like, that's a whole part of the plot that's never explained to us. Like, they're capturing women for what reason?
Yeah.
But
Well,
like
yeah.
Lynch movies, I feel like this is a world that's in some ways magical. Like, to me, like, the most strike one of the first striking things that happens in the movie is when they go to this fortune teller. They stole this entirely out of Dune, but they go to this he goes to this fortune teller, and she's this old lady like in a chair, and her young blonde granddaughter is there and is like talking. She keeps saying like, my grandmother thinks this or my grandma thinks that, but the grandmother's not talking, she's talking. And then she's like, grandma wants to play a game. And then this black box just fades in. It just appears in front of him. And I think what makes it more uncanny is that there's no noise. Like, if there was a like sci-fi noise, it would somehow be different. But the fact that it just appears slowly without any, with silently. And I want to also talk about the sound, because the sound in this movie is incredible. The way it's silent, the silently just appears in front of him. You're like, oh, this world is magic. There's magic in this world.
Right.
Cause like, you know, if you were writing like in a screenwriting class, and you're like writing a horror movie, the screenwriting professor would be like, what's the fortune teller? And
Yeah.
she can like make things like what? Like it's this other element that I think like to makes total sense, but also ma doesn't make sense.
Yep. Yeah, so let's talk about that scene for a second, right? So Mike goes to this girl's grandmother's house, and this box appears in front of this fortune teller grandmother. She's wearing these like very dark shades. They're very narrow on her face, you know, which gives it an interesting look to begin with. And she's dressed like she's from like 100 years ago. Then she tells him to, or the granddaughter tells him to put the hand, his hand in the box. He does that, and it is right from the Dune book. What's interesting is that this scene predates David Lynch's Dune, which is the first adaptation of Dune, right? So like Dune, I think the David Lynch Dune came out in like 81, I think. So he sticks his hand in the box, and it's like almost exactly the same scene as when Paul puts his hand in the box. And
He even says fear is the killer.
exactly. And the grandmother looks like a Bene Gesserit witch from Dune too. So you know, it's exactly the same kind of sequence. And I know that, I mean, you said it, they stole it from Dune. It's like they're just doing that scene. And it does play a part in the rest of the movie, but there's never in any of the Phantasm movies, there's never like this direct explanation for like why this fortune teller woman is there. What's her connection to the tall man? Is there a connection to the tall man? There's nothing like that. So
But it's also
it's
in, yeah, I'm sorry.
no, please go ahead.
It's going back to the liminal thing too. It's also interesting because, like Paul Atreides, right? Or like Luke Skywalker or whatever, like it's that thing of like boy becoming man. Like this is, I mean, in a literal sense, it sets up later that he has the bravery to put his hand through the portal into the other world. He hears like, don't be afraid, and he puts his hand in. And he actually gains knowledge. Like he goes in for a second and sees, but then when he comes out, he's like, oh, they're slaves, and the reason they're small is because of the heat and because of the like he all of a sudden has all of this in knowledge of what's going on in that world just for having seen it for a second. But again, it's that thing of like it's his journey into adulthood. Even like, not to be like Freudian or crude, but even like putting your hand in something that you don't totally understand
Whoa.
is oh we just we earned our explicit rating is something like it's almost the opposite of the other thing you see a lot in like in fiction, which is like you get a phallus, like whether it be King Arthur's sword or the jizz Spider-Man can shoot through his things, or Harry Potter's wand, or Luke Skywalker's lightsaber. Like the
Yeah.
boy becomes a man by getting a sort of symbolic penis. In this, and I guess in somebody's Dune, like his first step towards manhood is putting his hand in something he doesn't know. I know it sounds like I'm being ridiculous, but there's something to me that makes Michael's story in the movie have this whole different, like almost philosophical trajectory. It's not just he's on this adventure, he's like becoming a man. Like even at the end, there's an interesting moment where they're like, do you think they turned mom and dad into these Jawa people? And when they go to they at the end, when they go back to the mausoleum, he takes out his father's coffin, and the older brother Jody is gonna open it, but then he stops himself and he goes, nah, he's in there. And then Michael, who's the younger one, he has the bravery that Jody doesn't to open it and see that he's not in there. And then
Yeah.
he doesn't have the heart to tell his brother the truth. So in some ways, like Michael's journey is kind of ellipses Jody's journey into like being a man.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, look, there's nothing wrong with your analysis there. I think that you're onto something. And you could tie it into this sort of like voyeurism that Michael has in the beginning of the movie, because he's like spying on his brother. There's this weird kind of relationship because like their parents aren't there, and he's worried that his brother is going to leave him, and so he's always kind of spying on his brother, which is what leads him to discover a lot of this tall man stuff. And he even like spies on his brother because at one point the brother, you know, he hits it off with the lady in lavender at the bar, and they go to the cemetery right where their friend was killed, and he's getting it on with her, but luckily they get interrupted before she can kill him, you know. So like, go ahead.
And him, the younger brother watching with binoculars always brings up the idea of like visual pleasure and cinema and the voyeurism of cinema. Even in that scene that you're just talking about where he almost hooks up with the lady in lavender, in there's a funny moment that I think actually truly explains what the theory of male gaze is. Because people think that the male gaze theory in cinema is just women on screen, and we're watching women on screen, and the camera is the male gaze.
Right.
You hear that all the time in like, pop criticism. But in the actual essay, Visual Pleasure Narrative Form, or Narrative Cinema, I forget what it's called, by Laura Mulvey, there's another step to it, which is that the male character on screen is seeing something. And yes, the cinema is the eye of the male character, but then it also the male viewer is also getting it. So it's like a three-part thing. So in the movie, Jody takes off the Lady Lavender's shirt, and you see her boobs, and he goes, wow. And then it cuts to Michael watching, and he goes, wow. So it's a funny joke because it's like a little kid seeing boobs. But the fact that both guys say, wow, that's actually like a perfect example of how the male gaze works in cinema. Like the younger brother is vicariously getting the exact same thrill that the older brother is.
Yes. And when I was watching it in my room by myself, I went, wow, when
Wow.
I saw
No, yeah,
the
the
two.
Lady Lavender is beautiful.
Coincidentally, or I don't know if it's coincidentally, but the woman that plays the Lady in Lavender, that those aren't her boobs. Like, she had like a stunt actress.
What?
Yes. Fake
Bullshit.
news, right? Everything is illusion in this series. But I get what you're saying, and there's something to it. It's weird because the movie has this kind of vibe in the beginning where they really are playing up this voyeurism aspect and the
Oh, yeah.
brother spying on the other brother, but then it kind of turns into this sort of sci-fi adventure
Yeah.
movie toward the end, and I'm all for it.
Oh, yeah.
I think that there's something to be said about the fact that the Lady in Lavender becomes the tall man. Like, I actually forgot about that until I rewatched it, and I was like, whoa, what? And I mean, there's got to be some kind of psychological thing behind that. One thing I want to point out, though, is that we're talking about David Lynch, we're talking about Don Coscarelli. I don't know if David Lynch or Don Coscarelli have these thoughts of like, this is going to represent the male
Oh
gaze,
no, not
or
at
like,
all. Not at all.
right, it's just us an analyzing it. I think that
Well,
for
yeah.
them, they're trying to tell like the most compelling story, and they want to put a specific image that they have in their mind on screen. And I think in the case of both Lynch and Coscarelli, they might not even know exactly what that image means. It's just something that they like saw. Like, I know, for example, when Don Coscarelli was writing Phantasm, he rented out like a cabin in the woods, and he was there for days, kind of isolated. And at one point, he like stuck a finger through a paper cup, and like he was just like looking at his finger in the paper cup, and that's where he got the idea for the tall man's severed fingers. So like, I think, and this is what I love about life in general, is that these kind of filmmakers, they'll just see something that excites them and they just put it in their movie. And it's not like they're sitting there being like, well, this means this and this connects to the lore. Like, I
Right,
think that's the problem with the majority of movies that come out now, is everything has to serve some kind of lore. It has to make sense to the audience, and that you're like talking to the audience in such a way that you would talk to like an 11-year-old child. Where you're
yeah.
like, the reason why this is happening. Whereas like real filmmakers make things and it doesn't even fucking make sense to them, but they think it'll like be interesting to look at.
Right. Well, I've said this a couple times before in the show, or maybe more than a couple times. It's been 8 years, everybody. But
Yeah.
I'm a sort of dyed in the wool post-structuralist critic. So and that's informed by things like the death of the author theory. And I think that authorship is not as important in meaning making as readership, and the reader makes the meaning. And I often don't think like filmmakers are or artists are thinking actively about these things. But I think the truth is that no one's authorship is entirely their own. You live in a culture, you use a language that you didn't create, you're part of a visual language you didn't create, and these things come through you. Like an example I always used to lo love to give was like, J.R.R. Tolkien used to say that Lord of the Rings is not about World War I and it's not reflecting World War II. And I believe that he believes that. It's just he's wrong. It came through. As
Yeah.
he's writing, it came through. These ideas, these cultural ideas, these memes, right, they come through. And that's why readership is so the reader is so important. So yeah, I don't think I think I don't to go back to Lynch, I don't think he thinks about anything. I think he dreams things up, he meditates, he gets things, and he does it. When
Yep.
people ask, Lynch about his movies and he goes, I don't want to explain or whatever. Or, you know, that great clip where they're like, can you elaborate? And he goes, no. I don't think
Classic.
he's being cagey. I think he really doesn't know, or he doesn't even feel like it's part of his process to wonder why he has the ideas he has.
Yeah, I think I might have said this in a previous recording, but like Bob, who's so crucial to like Twin Peaks mythology, right? Like such a big part of what Twin Peaks is. Bob, the guy that plays Bob, was a guy working on the set of Twin Peaks, and he was setting up a shot. And David Lynch saw him in Laura Palmer's bedroom, and he just was inspired by that image of him, and he filmed that guy, like just being in Laura Palmer's bedroom, and then that was in the mother's dream in that first episode, and then just Bob became a part of the
It
show,
just
and
changes
I think that's
everything. I mean, think about it. It's, the entire show has changed for a mistake, kind
right,
of.
exactly, and so like I know that for instance with Phantasm, like I said, Angus Scrim was working with Don Coscarelli in a previous film. And like Angus Scrim, just to kind of joke around, he would make these faces, like maybe even when they were doing makeup and stuff. And he would do that sort of like tall man look where he'd like squint his eye and the other eye'd be big. And I think that that influenced Don Coscarelli to make this character, you know? Another thing that's really interesting is that Angus Scrim, and I think that's not even his real name, right? But he's not even that tall in real life. And so I know that like he lost weight so he could like fit into these suits. And then they also have him wear like really high boots so that he's tall. So like he's like 6'7" in the movies because of this, but he's not really a tall guy to begin with. And I don't know. I just think that like it's interesting to have this kind of iconic character and like he's creepy. Just the idea of like a man working in a funeral home is inherently creepy. But there's never, I've watched five of these fucking movies, and there's never
Really?
like this clear cut explanation of like, oh, this is what he is. They do allude to like an origin for him, but even that's like very vague. You're like, oh, what the fuck does that mean then? You know?
That's, I'm glad. I was wondering if the sequels get further into like explaining things.
They don't, and like what's really good though is that like Reggie shines in the sequels, and it's funny because you watch this movie and it's like Reggie fucking dies at the end of this movie, right? Then all of a sudden he's alive again. And that happens a lot in
You mean
these movies
Jody
where,
or Reggie?
well, both of them, right? Because wouldn't you say that Reggie dies when
Sure, yeah.
he's with the
Yes,
lady
he
in
does.
lavender and she stabs him,
Right.
right?
But then they say
And
it's a dream and that Jody's dead. But even I haven't even seen the sequels, but I don't believe that.
then, yeah.
I'm like, no, this is a dream, or none of it matters.
Right. And that goes throughout the whole series because, like, even by the last film, which is, it's not as good as the rest of the movies, right? And it's directed by another guy, it's co-written by another guy. But they kind of imply that, like, Reggie might have, like, imagined this whole thing and that he's in a, like, a hospice at the end of the series. And that's one possible interpretation. Then there's another possible interpretation where, like, the tall man destroys the earth. And I mean, you can watch the movies and see what you think. But, Reggie is such an interesting character to me. And talking about that kind of getting inspired in the moment, there's that real funny scene that you texted me about where Reggie and Jody are just like sitting outside of the house playing guitar. Like Reggie pulled up in his ice cream truck. He just happens to have an acoustic guitar in his ice cream truck. And they play a song. And I fucking really love that song. I love how like Reggie just kind of comes in and he perfectly complements what Jody's playing. And that's actually Reggie Bannister's music. Like he plays music as well. He got a chance to like put his song into the movie. Like one other thing that I think is great is that like the characters are named after the people that play them. So
That's
like
what I was gonna
Reggie.
say. Like, is Reggie like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, was he like Don Coscarelli's like friend or his neighbor or whatever?
So Reggie Bannister is in that movie that has Angus Scrim and A. Michael Baldwin. That's right before Phantasm. A. Michael Baldwin's in that movie. And then A. Michael Baldwin is, I guess we could just call him Michael Baldwin, but he's not in Phantasm 2. They have another actor playing Mike in that one. But then he comes back and he's in Phantasm 3, 4, and 5, right? And Jody comes back in this weird form in Phantasm 3, 4, and 5 as well. So, like, they're just all friends of Don Coscarelli's, and they've been in this series for like 40 years. More than 40
That's
years.
crazy. And we Jody, I think, is interesting. Like, he you kind of don't get a total idea of his age. Like, his hair is a liminal space, right? Because he's bald, but then also has a ponytail. So it's like, what is this guy's deal? How old is he? He has an ice cream truck, kind of.
Yes.
It's like not a whole truck. But what his little ice cream outfit is like white pants, white shirt with like a black bow tie. He's
Yes.
like kind of, he just goes and hangs out at the house. He's like, hey, what's going on, guy? Like, he's a fascinating character.
Yep. I love Reggie. I love Reggie so much, and Reggie plays a much bigger part in the rest of the series. One thing that is like a through line through all the sequels is that like Reggie always tries to get with whoever the hot chick is in the movie. And there's always a hot chick who either gets killed because of the tall man, or like she's corrupted by the tall man and then she tries to kill Reggie. But it's just it becomes this joke of like Reggie trying to get with a woman, and he's like so over the top with trying to get with them.
Yeah.
It's like kind of ridiculous. It's kind of borders on predatory, and like he never succeeds. It's like funny, you know. It's like a main part of the series is Reggie just trying to get laid and then like something horrible happening.
Isn't he also in Bubba Hotep? Doesn't he
Yeah.
play like the administrator or something?
He absolutely is. Yeah, I think Reggie Bannister is maybe in every single Don Coscarelli film.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, now he's a really interesting character. Let's talk about, all right, let's talk about the, I'm going to say queerness, but I don't mean queer in a derogative sense. I mean it much more in like a critical sense. The
Sure.
queerness around the tall man, because the film begins with actually a pretty interesting visual of, you see like a, it's nighttime in a cemetery, and you see like a gravestone, but like coming out from behind the gravestone are like a pair, like two pairs of legs, like male legs and female legs. So like, oh, there's two kids like hooking up. And it's this beautiful woman. She has, beautiful breasts. She takes out like a knife and she stabs the guy and kills the guy that she was just screwing with. But the most important thing to say though is it's after the act of sex. Like, she has an orgasm and she seems to be enjoying it. And then she kills the guy. And then we see just like very simple cinema technique. Like, it's a close up of her and then it's a close up of the tall man. Right, it's not like she changes into him, but it just sort of it indicates to us that they're the same character.
Right.
And then later on, Jody goes to a bar which is called like Dune Tavern or whatever, also a Dune reference, right?
Right. Right.
And he goes to a bar and like the lady in lavender is just sitting there. She's just hanging out at the bar, like waiting for some, like waiting to get picked up. He goes over, talks to her. In like 5 minutes, they're like walking out already, and she's like, "Come, let's go this way." And they start like hooking up. The younger brother's watching, as we just said, right? He says, "Wow." The brother, the a Jawa ca character, and these I keep calling them Jawas. They call them dwarves in the movie, but they're like they make these weird like noises. So the brother's like, "Oh shit, what's that?" And the brother runs away. And then there's a funny bit where like the brother runs away, and then Jody like lifts his head up, and he's got like panties in his mouth. And he's like, "Oh
Right.
shit, my brother." And he was like, "But those are Angus Scrim's panties."
Yes.
And
And I'm good.
then he goes and deals with the brother, and then he comes back and she's gone. So you're right, this he could have been killed, but he it's a suspenseful thing because she would have killed him, but then doesn't. But that's the tall man. And so like I guess you could say this is a way that they kill people to get the to turn the dead bodies into these like slaves. But I don't know, there's other ways to do it than the tall man is getting his rocks off this way.
Yes. It to me, that's the part that kind of seems to make the least amount of sense, because the tall man seems so devoid of human emotion and any kind of like physical need whatsoever. Then for him to like become this woman that has sex with men before she kills him, it's so weird. And I know that Angus Scrim didn't even know that this was happening. Like he didn't know this was part of the story until he watched the final cut of the
Well, he
movie,
didn't
like in the
realize
theater.
that she was him as well.
That's right.
Because he becomes her again at the end. Like when Michael's running at the end, like he becomes her for a minute. So it's
Yep.
like he likes being her.
Yeah.
In the sequels, does he do that at all?
The lady in lavender comes back, but it's not like there's any kind of scene of sex with her, and then it's not like she turns into the tall man. There's also like one of Reggie's love interests in the second movie. It was this woman, and there's this really awkward sex scene between Reggie and this woman. At the very end of the movie, she's driving the hearse that they've escaped in, and there's Mike in the back, and there's this girl that he's with, and then the girl that Reggie's with, her name's like Alchemy, and they call her Kemi, and like a piece of her hair falls off, and like you see like a part of her scalp, and it's all bloody and stuff. So it's implying that she like is one of these reanimated corpses. And I know that like Don Coscarelli wanted it to be that she turned into the Tall Man, just like the lady in Lavender. And they even tried to make up effects where like there was part of her face like on the tall on Angus Scrim's face as well. But that's kind of all you get of this kind of stuff in the sequels.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's heteronormative to see it as odd. I mean, I guess it's odd because maybe that's wrong. It's odd because the Tall Man seems like he has one job in life, which is to like run this whole operation. And the fact that he's also like, oh, I'm gonna become the lady and go to a bar right now. It's almost like drag in a way or something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, I
Not
think that's
trans.
why.
I don't, and I specifically mean like not trans, but more like drag, because it seems like it's a performance thing for him. Although he does like, or they, I mean, it's also possible that like there is no gender. Like he's an alien that looks like a man and then looks like a woman. But to me, it
Yeah.
is interesting though that it's not just, oh, I'm gonna lure you in with sex and then kill you.
Yeah.
It's that like it they have sex. They go
Yeah.
the whole way.
Yeah. I mean, there's not much said about the tall man. The implication is that, like, he does say this one line in one of the sequels where he's like, "You think when you die, you go to heaven? When you die, you come to me or you come to us." He says something like that. So it's like implying that there's no happy afterlife, that we're all part of this process. There's also the implication that, like, he's building up this army, or he's like getting servants by taking the dead, from Earth and like shrinking them into these dwarves. But I mean, it's weird. The only allusion we get to his origin in the sequels is that Mike has like this flashback where he like goes back in time and he sees this guy, Jebediah Sunshine, I believe that's his name, and that is. He's played by Angus Scrim, but he's all nice and stuff. And the implication is that this guy like invented some kind of device that could help him like phase into another dimension. And he goes into the other dimension and then he comes back as the tall man. So something happened to him. You don't know what happened to him, but and there's more lore with like the balls and stuff.
Right, because
And
what are
one.
the balls really, other than looking awesome and being the most
Yeah.
iconic thing, like what do they do? What's the point of them?
Right. So like, I remember for like the trailer for the second movie, like they end the trailer with the ball is back. Like that's like it's like we're so excited about the fucking ball, right? But even the ball is sort of like a thing that's ripped off from Dune as well, because in
Oh,
Dune
sure.
they have these things called Hunter Seekers, which are these sort of like little flying devices that will just like find you and then poison you and kill you.
Oh,
So I
right.
think that's a Dune kind of reference there too. In future sequels, they show like a person's brain inside, or a piece of a brain inside of one of the balls too. So like the balls themselves have like a consciousness, and they do all kinds of weird different things in the sequels as well. Like they have different powers and stuff too.
Interesting. Okay. I really
Yeah,
want to watch the sequels now.
I would say like at least watch up till four, because it's I don't know, it's kind of the same story over and over again, and they diminish in quality, but it's just kind of fun to watch the whole series. And then, like, one other thing we should also talk about is the idea of like the tuning fork.
Yeah.
And yeah. What'd you think of
No,
that?
you take it away because I'm not sure how I read that.
Yeah. So it's another thing where it's like, it's never fully explained. Like, they have the scene where Jody and Reggie are playing their songs. Then Reggie just pulls out a tuning fork and hits it. And they're like, look at this. And so there's some kind of significance with the tuning fork. And it does affect the tall man. Like, when they cross over into that other dimension at the end of the movie, the two like pillars, those two metal pillars, are kind of reminiscent of a tuning. So it's implied that like somehow using sound, you're able to go into different dimensions. And that's like a kind of like a manifestation thing. That's like a thing that is in comics, like with the Flash and stuff. There's always this talk of by changing your vibration, you could go to another reality. So that's like something that's been in science fiction for like decades, you know?
Okay.
And it was kind of hard to follow that up. You're like, well, what, you know, but that's the
No,
thing. It's just like,
it's just another interesting thing. It's just another element.
right.
It's just like you said, it's interesting choices. It's like a very interesting like soup. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of just ideas here. Like there's just a lot of ideas because tuning and sound is a part of it. Like the movie, you know, because he Reggie has the tuning fork and then he like touches it with his two fingers and it stops and it's silent. And then he does the same thing at the end, but also like the room that has the portal has a hum to it and it like draws people in. Like this is very unexplained. Maybe it was part of what was like cut out, but like the daughter of the fortune teller, we just see her go into the mausoleum and she opens a door and then she screams and it's like what was her like, why did she go there? And then the actual sound design in the movie is great because like I said, with the black box that appears, it appears without a sound effect. And there's a lot of moments that are silent. There's a lot of moments where you think there would be a sound effect and there aren't. And there's a lot of voiceover stuff. There's a lot of that great score that repeats over and over again. You know, early on, there's a when he goes to see the fortune teller, there's this really like that whole sequence is interesting because there's all these weird like temporal ellipses where it's like he goes to the fortune teller and he's like, I'm afraid my brother's gonna leave. And then it cuts to another scene and you're like, oh, is this just another scene? And it's he's working on a car and his brother's talking to his brother's friend and he's talking about leaving. And then the conversation of him talking about leaving continues. But then you see him drive away and you see Michael like chasing after the car as he drives away. And you're like, wait, what is this? Is this right after that conversation? Is this him imagining something? Or is this right after that conversation? We just skip to the future. But then we go back to the fortune teller and they realize that was him explaining his fear of his brother leaving. So it's like when Deadpool's like, oh, a fourth wall break inside a fourth wall break. Like this was a flashback. But then when inside the flashback, there was a flash forward and all of these weird. You know, it's always an interesting thing when film, you know, film is just a magic trick with all these disparate parts coming together to make an illusion, right? And phantasm means illusion, right? A phantasm is an illusion, a figure in your imagination. When the time and space are disconnected in a way, it's I think it's always very, very powerful. This is a completely different example, but like the one that always comes to mind for me is there's this great documentary called Paris is Burning, which is about drag culture in New York in the 80s. And there is a character, and this was a documentary, so this is a real, these are all real people. There's a character who was really more trans than drag, like they lived as that's their identity. And that character is killed, and you hear like a news report of like the character's body being found, but what you're seeing, what you hear that is footage of the character alive, and then right when the news report ends, the character goes, "Oh, I'm hungry," which is like there's nothing more alive than being hungry. So just like to me, that's the most powerful example I can think of in cinema of taking time and space and ripping them apart like that and putting them over each other. We are seeing an image of this person very much alive while we're hearing a report about their death.
Yeah, and you know, we keep talking about David Lynch. I think that that's one of the things that he does pretty frequently,
Yeah.
where like the time, and Christopher Nolan kind of does this as well, where it's like the time frame of one scene, you kind of understand it, you're like, oh, this is taking course over like 10 minutes, but then they'll cut to another scene where it's like it's maybe taken days for it to happen.
Yeah.
And then they might cut back to that first 10-minute sequence, and you're like, oh, that it's always very jarring. And then this movie has that too, where it's just, you know, you're expecting a movie, like a movie the way it normally works, a conventional movie, it's just like, okay, this scene happens, it takes this amount of time, then there's the next scene, and it's like you're just going in a linear motion. But with this movie and with David Lynch in general, you could like start a scene somewhere, go off some way, then
Yeah.
come back to that scene. And it's very unsettling because you're expecting a movie to be a certain way. And I think that that might be indicative of, or that might be a part of Don Coscarelli's filmmaking style too,
Yeah.
because it happens in all the sequels. I mean, I've only seen for his movies, I've only seen the five Phantasm movies and then Bubba Hotep. But Bubba Hotep even has this thing that's like the Phantasm movies where the characters kind of telling this like sort of melancholy
Yeah.
narration about their lives, and they sound so kind of sad, and they always sound kind of like, well, that's the way the world is, it just sucks, and there's crazy mummies that live in nursing homes, and there's or there's this guy, the tall man, that's hunting me. And it always seems silly when you listen to their dramatic monologue and they're like describing this fucking bonkers world that the
Yeah.
story is set in, because the monologue always sounds like, well, I had two kids and then one of them got really sick and they died. It like feels like that, but they're like, he makes these dwarves and the dwarves come after you. It's so like
Yeah.
jarring and feels weird, but it's kind of why I love it.
Yeah. If I watched this as a little kid, I would have been like bored and been like, I don't like what if movies confused me, I would be so upset by them. I'd be like angry at them. And I think that a lot of people, a lot of average film goers do feel that way. Like when a movie confuses them, they like, fuck this. They get mad at it or something.
Right.
I like being confused by a movie. I like when a movie, because movies should be, I mean, the thing in cinema is like it is an illusion, right? Cinema itself is a phantasm. It's these different little bits that aren't really related, but you put them together and it creates an illusion.
Yeah.
And often narrative is what keeps that illusion going. There's narrative techniques that sort of take suture is the word they use, like sutures together all these little openings, like really, like when a shot, when you edit, right, and a shot goes to another shot, like every cut is a jump cut. Like that should be, I'm jarring to you. And the reason it often isn't in mainstream films is because the narrative is what is sort of like suturing it. The narrative is like a band-aid over it, keeping it together. But
Right.
a filmmaker like Lynch or Coscarelli, they're not allowing that suture. They're purposefully opening those wounds up and saying like, look, it doesn't make sense. Like movies don't make sense. They shouldn't make sense. Even when you think they make sense, they don't.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty profound, man. I mean, that's what is so great about this series, right? Is just that you, like, I think, okay. When you talk about the average moviegoer, right? That's the majority of the population. Then
Yeah.
you have like weirdos like you and me and Danny and stuff that just like consume media constantly.
Yeah.
And I think that like it's kind of like taking drugs or any kind of other thing that you're really into. Like when you consume so much of it, you get bored of what you're expecting, and so you want something different.
Yeah.
And this series is different. I think that there's many people that have probably watched this series and been like, what the fuck was that? That is so weird. But like we eat that shit up because it's just like it, like for me, watching a movie, the most exciting thing is when I don't know what's gonna happen or they do
Yeah.
something that like I've not anticipated. I'm usually like six steps ahead, like, oh, okay, I know how this is gonna all play out. You're gonna have this scene by the end. But when you watch a movie like this, you're like, what the fuck is this new thing now? It's
Right.
so bizarre. Yeah.
I think some people get mad when they feel like it's not an easy read when it's challenging them.
Right.
Similar to like unhappy endings. I think sometimes people get mad when they're unhappy endings because they assume that there was going to be a happy ending and they feel like they've been like quote unquote like ripped off. And it's like, why? Like, what did you pay for? What did you think you were getting? Like when you watch
Right.
a movie and the protagonist, like if like a horror movie, right? Where like something like spoiler alert, The Descent, where in the end nobody lives, like you're not being ripped off. Like, well, you got a whole movie, but it's, you
Right.
know. It's just it's less literacy, I guess, media literacy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it also like the more stuff you watch, the more you're kind of bored with stuff. So you like you love being confused. You love being like, I don't know what the fuck this is. You
Right,
know,
right.
it's not like I understand these things. Like it's not like I watch David Lynch movies and I'm like, oh, I get this. I'm so smart. Like I
Right.
don't get it because it's ungettable, and
Right.
I enjoy that experience.
Exactly. It comes down to an experience. And I think a lot of people just think of movies as like pleasure that's a distraction from your everyday life. And not a lot of people consider movies to be art. They almost think of movies as like a separate thing from art, because
Yeah.
art is supposed to be interpreted and it's supposed to evoke a specific feeling within the person that's looking at it. And I think that just a lot of people look at movies as like, oh, well, this is just going to be a fun time for 2 hours, like a fun little break where I could turn off my brain. And you know, people like us, we're sitting there being like, oh, is the tall man, is he in drag, is it, you know, like, what does this mean when he puts his hand in the box, is that a vagina, like, you know, we're just sitting there thinking about all these things, you know. And but that's like fun for us, but like for most normal people, that they would just be like, what does this scene even mean, why did this movie have this scene,
Yeah.
you know. Yeah.
The box is a vagina, everybody.
Yes.
Peter, it's always such a pleasure to have you on the show. You come with a great perspective and knowledge. For people who are now fans of you from listening to this, where can they get more?
Yes, that my growing fan base. You know what? I would like my growing fan base from Pop Culture Man Children to come check out my channels. Come check out Comic Books Transformed, where me and my friend Brian, we talk about shows and movies that have been adapted from comic books. Right now, we're covering Peacemaker. There's the final two episodes of that left. We're going to cover the second season of Gen V, which just came out. We're going to cover Marvel Zombies. So we have a lot of stuff to talk about. Most of it's subpar, but.
Ha
But no, Peacemaker has its moments, and Gen V will be entertaining. Then there is the LasserCast, where Danny and I, we had Brian come on that channel, and we covered Alien Earth. We still have to cover the final episode of Alien Earth. But Danny and I have other things. I know Danny wants to cover like The Long Walk, which is just in theaters, and there's some other horror movies. There's that movie, I think it was called Him, that came out. That's like
Oh,
the sports horror movie or the football horror movie. And then last but not least, I actually have my old channel, which used to be called Anchor Pete. I've changed it to Aether and ATX. And it's just basically me talking about my experiences, like trying to manifest things, like using manifestation. And it's very personal, kind of, it's almost like a journal of a channel. But I think I say some interesting things on there. I'd love some more views on those videos. So yeah, come check them out.
wonderful. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you have a wonderful Halloween season.
I will.
We end every episode by saying,
Go bye-bye.